So let's take it back to the year 2000, the Sydney Olympics. At age 19, this young half-black, half-Jewish kid named Anthony Irvin, who also happens to suffer from Tourette syndrome, bursts onto the scene and shocks the swimming world by winning an Olympic gold medal in the 50-meter freestyle, and thereby becoming the fastest man on the planet and the very first African-American to win gold. And this is a title that would soon begin to haunt him for reasons we're going to get into in the podcast. In any event, over the next 3 years, Anthony goes on to win 2 world championships, 7 NCAA titles for Berkeley, and a whole host of additional amazing accolades. So this is an athlete for whom the future is indeed looking bright and brighter every single day. But then, at the very peak of his career, at the young age of 22, when he's still improving and getting faster and aiming towards another Olympic Games, Anthony shocks the swimming world a second time by retiring out of the blue. This is something that no athlete does who's still on the rise. It just doesn't happen. But Anthony is like this free-spirited guy. He's an independent deep thinker, sort of a beat poet kind of character trapped in the body of a once-in-a-generation athlete. Anthony had just become disillusioned with sport. He started questioning what he was doing, why he was doing it. He started questioning everything about his life and decided to spend the next several years on this sort of spirit quest. He traveled the world. He had a stint living in Brooklyn for a period of time, playing in a rock band. He was experimenting with a lot of drugs. He was chain smoking, getting a lot of tattoos, crashing his motorcycle. You get the idea. This is a guy who even hawked his gold medal on eBay to raise funds for tsunami flood relief. But the one thing he didn't do was swim. Not a single stroke. In fact, none of the people he was hanging out with even knew that he was an athlete, let alone an Olympic gold medalist. Then, after an 8-year retirement from the sport, which is literally a lifetime in swimming years, Anthony jumps back into the pool around 2011 and once again shocks the swimming world for a third time by making the London Olympic team in 2012 in the 50-meter freestyle. So let me put things in perspective. This is yet another thing that just doesn't happen, like ever. This is a sport in which athletes are afraid to even take a couple weeks off, let alone years. So Anthony's story is just awe-inspiring in this regard. And of course, it's a testament to his amazing talent. But to me, it's more about his spirit. It's more about the emotional journey that has delivered him from that place to here. And to really punctuate all of this, just last week, at the age of 35, as the oldest competitor at the United States Swimming Olympic Trials, Anthony punched his ticket to Rio by taking second place in the 50 free. He lost that race by just 1/100th of a second behind Nathan Adrian. And he did it in a time faster than the time he swam at the Olympic Trials in both 2000 and 2012. Like, how does that even make sense? He also locked a spot on the 4x100 free relay by placing fourth in the 100-meter free. So this performance in these two races just a couple weeks ago shocked the swimming world again for a fourth time. This is a guy who's now made 3 Olympic teams, his first Olympic team at 19 and just the other week at age 35. This achievement is just so amazing. I almost feel like you have to be or have been a swimmer to truly appreciate it. It just doesn't compute. The word extraordinary doesn't do it justice. I followed Anthony's career for many years. He's always been a very interesting and colorful person to follow. And I was really touched when I read his book that came out a couple months ago. It's a memoir. It's called Chasing Water. It's completely unlike any sports memoir I've ever read. It's wholly original, very inventive and unique in its style, complete with black and white drawings and this graphic story extra, something I've never seen in a memoir before. And also in the way that it tells this really kind of surprising and provocative journey that Anthony has taken to becoming what I think is one of the most interesting, dynamic, multifaceted, and perhaps complicated Olympic heroes of our day, our era. So it was really something to spend the better part of a day with him several months ago and record this conversation. But here's the thing. I wasn't actually going to air this conversation. Anthony is just so remarkable, and I felt like I didn't do the greatest job of getting the best and the most out of him in this conversation, and that's a responsibility that rests squarely on my shoulders. It has nothing to do with him. Also, we had a few tech issues with the recording, not the least of which was that it just cuts off about two-thirds into the conversation, leaving only a portion of the conversation itself. Literally a third of what we talked about just disappeared. This has never happened before. It hasn't happened since. I did everything to try to recover it. I don't know what happened. The file got corrupted or something. In any event, that's a bummer, right? So for these reasons, I asked Anthony before Olympic trials if he'd be willing to do a do-over, which is something I've never done before. It's not something I do. I have these conversations and I put them up, warts and all, no matter how they sound. But in this particular case, it seemed to make the most sense for obvious reasons, and Anthony agreed. He said, no problem, let's definitely do it. Then he did what he did last week at Olympic trials, and now I can't imagine not sharing this. I mean, first of all, there's no way I'm going to be able to sit down with Anthony again until sometime after the Olympics, so I'm going to have to wait a considerable period of time. And second, and most important, I want all of you guys, the audience, to know who this guy is going into Rio so that you can watch him and cheer for him with a better idea of the person behind the story, behind the tattoos. And I think all of you guys are ultimately, after listening to this, going to become rabid fans of Anthony Irvin. So there you have it. My apologies for this not being a perfect recording or a perfect interview. My apologies for the tech issues, for it just cutting out in mid-thought and leaving everyone hanging. That part really stinks. It just is what it is, right? I could air it or I could not air it, but I'd rather share it and have you guys enjoy it for what it is. And my hope is that you'll just get a better idea of who Anthony is and why I wanted to share his journey with you guys. And I promise I will get Anthony back in here after Rio to recap his Olympic experience, his Olympic trials experience, and cover what got cut out in the recording that you're about to hear and complete the circle, so to speak. So, at its core, this is a conversation that's really less about sport than it is about duality. It's about sport versus life. It's about public versus private identity, balance versus exceptionalism. It's about self-preservation versus self-destruction, ego versus humility, service versus selfishness, attachment versus surrender. And it's also about heritage and race and identity and priorities. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's about what is truly important. With all that said, please enjoy this first conversation with my friend, Anthony Irvin. You were just with Michael?
I was.
Oh, man. He's the best.
I love that guy. I told him that I was coming up here, and he just, like, stopped.
Oh,
was,
yeah?
Like, I got into this because of Rich Roll.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, he's a special guy. Do you work with him?
No, not until recently, where Ariana Cookers, I was talking with her. I did a couple clinics with her.
Uh-huh.
And just talking to her, and she's like, oh, you know, you should meet him. I work with him all the time. You should have him on for a podcast. So I'm like,
yeah, that's great. His show is fantastic. I had him on my podcast a while. It was probably like 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half ago at this point. But it was just a fantastic conversation. And then he starts emailing me. He's like, hey, how does all this podcasting stuff work? And I was like, you should do it. I mean, because he's so intuitive and inquisitive and thoughtful and conscientious. Like, I just think it's a great medium for him. And his show is like taken off. So that's really cool that you did it. You all right, man? Choking on a banana.
Banana's revenge.
Uh-huh. So you did that today?
I did that today.
Uh-huh. So you're not going to be podcast burned out?
No. He was really good. I like the way he steered questions and the way he couches for his audience.
Right.
You know, finding mastery. You know, right. That's the thing. And whether I spoke to mastery at all very much, I'll leave that up to the listeners to decide. But it was a good situation. And I know that you're bringing a totally different thing. So I know it's going to be a totally different conversation.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it goes.
and I believe you actually looked at the book. You have.
Yeah. I read the book. I'm almost done. I didn't, the only part I haven't really gotten to is the graphic story at the end.
Oh,
which is kind of amazing.
The appendices.
Right? Yeah. So I have to read that. I'm savoring it. but this book is, I mean, this is an amazing book, dude. You did
a
really great job. And there's so many things I want to say about it, but I think, you know, first and foremost, I would say that in general, I'm not a huge fan of like athlete memoirs or autobiographies. They tend to be sort of boring. They're generally written with the idea of extending like a brand, you know, in the twilight of an athlete's career. And they're rarely honest or vulnerable, but your book really is all of that. Like it's incredibly, revealing and interesting in the way that it's, assembled, because it's almost like a hallucinogenic trip. You know what I mean? It's not really linear. It is and it isn't. Like you go on these tangents and then it goes back and forth between, you know, your recollections and snippets from your life that aren't necessarily, sort of logically oriented. They're more like ruminations mashed up against your co-writer's, you know, sort of more methodical approach to kind of plotting through your life. And it's super interesting, and all the art that's interspersed with, you know, your tattoos and it's very literary as well, which I was surprised. I mean, I guess not surprised knowing like your background and kind of your persona and all of that, but I was gripped by it, and it's really a fantastic read. So
thank you very much.
Congratulations, man.
Yeah, there definitely was a conscientious effort to steer away from what would be considered a traditional athlete, like biography or memoir. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Constantine, my co-author, you know, he feels the same way. And we really thought that if we're going to do it, let's be creative with it. And yes, I am honest and vulnerable, but I mean, to be fair, I pick my battles.
Right.
You know, there were some things I'm like, I'm not going anywhere near that. No, completely got left out, you know, so.
Yeah, I think one of the articles that I read in preparation for this was the Vice piece, which I thought was really, that was a great article.
Oh,
and,
thanks.
And, you were kind of defending that it's a tell a lot, but it's not a tell all.
Yeah. No one wants to hear it.
Yeah.
It becomes a tell all. I was like, nobody wants to hear it. That's really just for me at that point.
Right. Well, also when there's other people that are implicated.
That became a big concern. You know, that was probably my greatest worry when, the bulk of the research was done and we're writing it section by section. And then when we had a full first draft of just, you know, there was a certain comfort or acceptance of nailing myself up for a lot of things, but I didn't want anybody else. It's not my right to do that to anybody else. So trying to protect certain people became important. Contacting them and finding out what their limits were. And then, you know, stopping there. And then for others, if there was no contact or I just didn't want to go through it,
right,
their anonymity was somewhat preserved.
Right. Well, there's one girlfriend in there that just goes by K.
Yeah.
So I noticed that. And I'm sure, did you send sections to people and say, hey, listen, I'm thinking about putting this in, and they're just like, no way.
No, actually everybody for whom it went in there where they might not have known, where they drew a hard line. It was before, you know, the prose had been written,
right.
You know, cause we had design, and then from there, we, you know, we filled in the prose and we decided upon style for each section and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only places I really kind of got disappointed where I wanted some more that wasn't given was my parents.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like, there are places where they're like, no.
Right. They didn't want it.
And I respect that, you know.
Yeah. When I wrote my book, my mom was terrified.
My mom was terrified too. And then I sent it to her. I let her read the section about her earlier on, way before it went to the final draft was done. And she kind of got like really silent and introspective when usually, you know, she marches around the house with a wooden spoon like it's a scepter because she's in control.
Uh-huh.
She kind of like sat and got quiet and didn't say anything for the rest of the time I was at home. You know, it was just like a weekend. And that put me off a little bit. It perturbed me. And I was a little bit worried, and I tried to talk her out of it, and she, you know, didn't really want to deal and kind of brushed it off. And then I sent her the final draft that I had from when I was editing. And she read the whole thing before everybody else got it. And, you know, she sends me a text. She's just like, I don't come off as much of a monster, so it's okay. You know? So, I don't know. And for her, like, that's for her.
Not
that's
exactly
a joke.
Like, this is an amazing book. Congratulations.
No,
but sort of giving you permission, right?
Yeah.
Well, your mom figures prominently in the book. I mean, she's really, you know, a pillar of strength throughout. And, you know, at times kind of a taskmaster and taciturn, but also somebody who fiercely defended you always.
All the time.
Yeah.
To the point of error. You know, like sometimes she falsely defended me, but she was a good mother in that. Uh-huh. And she does loom large. You know, it's, you know, taskmaster and protector, but that also implies a lot of control as well.
Right.
And, you know, growing up is a process of shaking those controls and learning how to control oneself.
Yeah. Which all kind of, it started to break loose when you got to Berkeley.
Yeah, the floodgates just opened.
Like, I mean, there's so many things that, you know, our stories are very different, but obviously because I come from a swimming background also, like I just was so tapped into the narrative and there were so many things that I related to, you know, deeply, just the emotions of the experience. And there's so many kind of dichotomies and tensions throughout the book, like this, you know, quest for identity that rubs up against, you know, the sort of, you know, de facto, limiting aspects of what it means to be a swimmer at that level. You know, this quest for freedom that butts up against the imprisonment of being this person who does this thing. And that quest for self-expression and identity that mashes up against, you know, the identity that's imposed upon you by the sport and, you know, that you participate in and the accomplishments that you've achieved and what the media decides to say about you.
Oh, yeah. There's rampant dualities that are at tension with each other.
I made a list of all the dualities. So I was like normal versus extraordinary, cowardice, courage, fear, and being unafraid, conformity and acting out, calculation that comes up against instinct, freedom and imprisonment, discipline and anarchy. That's a huge one, right?
Yes.
Attention and privacy. All these sorts of things. It just the whole book is kind of riddled with those things that make it so interesting.
Yeah, you nailed it, right?
Well, let's take it back because you know, a lot of people don't know your story, and it's one of the most incredible stories and so many ups and downs. So you start out, I mean, you grew up like you were living in Canoga Park at one point, not too far from where we are right now. You're an LA kid.
Yeah. I grew up in Canoga Park, or at least that was the house I was born into, and got my first taste of the water there. We had a pool in the backyard, and, you know, but it wasn't too long where, you know, in pursuit of that old style American dream, you know, my parents wanted to own their own house. So they moved further out into the undeveloped suburbs to have their own place and raise a family.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, I do consider myself a SoCal guy. When I'm traveling and stuff, people ask where I'm from. I say LA. And it's like, oh, I'm from LA. I'm like, okay, I'm not from LA. I'm from the valley, then the valley above the valley.
Yeah, Valencia is really, I mean, that's where you went to high school, right?
That's
Which is, you know, quite a ways north of here.
Mm-hmm.
And when does, I mean, you have this story in the book where, you know, it's sort of clear early on this affinity for the water when you kind of tiptoe to your pool when you're too young to swim and you're like, I'm a swimmer, you know, and then the gate goes up around the pool the next day. But when is it that you know, swimming
there,
like clicks in as something that you're, you know, you have this affinity for?
As far as achievement based and competition?
Yeah. Or just, you know, something that you enjoyed perhaps.
Well, That was the episode, you know, and that's too young for me to remember, but it's the story. It's one of my mom's like favorite stories to tell me again and again and again. And, you know, Constantine did our best to capture that in literary form. But you know, that was it. Like she always told me, I loved being in the water. I'd beg to be taken into the water. And, there's something about in your very, very early years, like less than 1 year old, where you have a greater affinity for being in the water, and that kind of erodes and goes away the longer you're kept from it as you continue to grow and get more comfortable walking and then running on land.
Right. And, but that affinity never left you, right? Like that was just,
never got a chance to.
On some level, there's this destiny aspect to it, you know, I suppose that you could read into it. But I get the sense that for you initially, you know, the water, the pool. I mean, the book is called Chasing Water, right? So the water holds this special symbolic meaning for you that equates to, you know, freedom.
that.
It can.
It can, yeah.
It certainly
but
can.
But it's the, it goes back to that duality.
That's where
the
I love it
the freedom
that
most. Becomes your prison, right?
Yeah.
So the competitive aspect kicks in mm-hmm. when?
I think I was 7 years old. Go to my first swim meet. It was at the pool that I practiced at and was learning the strokes. And in one of the events, I just completely blew out everybody and jumped to, you know, they called it a double A time standard. Uh-huh, so I went from having like that C no time straight to double A. And that's kind of like a regional meet that you get to go to. And right then, you know, the social ramifications of that kind of achievement kick in where the coaches are beaming. The older, like the big kid coaches are like coming by and saying hi and know my name. Mm-hmm. The family is excited and my teammates are kind of in awe, you know? And so right away, there's kind of like this, reflection from those around you that what you did was good and mm-hmm. you want more of that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And hence begins the crafting of an identity around this.
Mm. Well, in becoming Sucker too, you need it.
Yeah.
At a certain point, it becomes what defines you.
Right. Right. And so at what point do you start, you know, training? Do you end up doing like the double workout thing and all of that through high school? I mean, you kind of burn out at one point until you get to high school and there's a coach and, you know, some teammates that you seem to click with that
yeah.
rejuvenates your passion.
Yeah, very much so throughout the journey, you know, with my life and life in the water, which are largely one and the same. It's always been about the relationships. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I had a lull where I was not doing well, not performing well, and really struggling with that as I entered puberty and only kind of started to find my gift again towards the end of high school. And what was the original question?
I don't know. But when you were a senior in high school, were you getting recruited all over the place? Like
no.
What I got from the book was that you reached a certain level of proficiency. Like you were good, right? And you were going to be able to swim in college.
Right.
But it wasn't like you were blasting out NAG records all over the place.
No.
And, you know, on everybody's radar as like the next great sprinter.
Right. I didn't have a NAG.
Right.
Ever growing up.
Which means national age group record for those people that are listening.
Right, yeah, right, right, right. And those are the people that would be on the radars, people mm-hmm. who have NAGs in multiple events.
Right. So it's interesting because, you know, now, you know, the unanimous opinion is, you know, you have just, you know, oodles of natural talent and, mm-hmm. you know, one of the most naturally gifted sprinters that ever, you know, there's like all kinds of,
yeah.
you know, accolades that are out there and all your colleagues that, you know, have said kind things about your ability, but it seems to me from reading the book that wasn't necessarily self-evident, you know, at age 18.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And except with one exception, one guy.
Mike?
Mike Bottom.
Yes.
Who was able to see something in you that seems like other people, you know, didn't have the discernment for at that time.
He did. He saw something in both my rebellion and what that outlook, the resistance to conformity to what's established, you know, and how to go about things and how to get better, that I had found a way of my own to be as good as so many other people who do it the quote unquote like natural way or like what mm-hmm. is the establishment's way. So I think he saw that and he, being the kind of coach that he is, believed that he could coach me to the next level.
Right.
And he totally did.
I want to get into Mike Bottom in a minute. He's the coach at Cal.
Or he was. He's in Michigan.
Right.
Now.
That's right. He's not there anymore. Extraordinary guy. I had the good fortune of swimming with his brother, Dave, at Stanford,
okay.
who is
that's
also
right.
an amazing dude as well. But first question I have is, what is it about? I mean, you're the poster boy for like rebellious sprinter, but I think in general, the conventional wisdom is, you know, sprinters by their very nature are sort of iconoclastic in comparison to the other swimmers. So what do you think it is about sprinters that make them this different kind of breed?
I think that's the way it was when we were coming up, that mantle of rebellion as like as the representative rebel of the team would be the sprinter. I think that's changed though. I think the old guard is starting to move on. And now there's so much talk about like USRPT, which is, you know, race pace training. Mm-hmm. So people, they don't do massive amounts of yardage or spending lots and lots of time training. Instead, they keep it very brief, very specific, and very much geared around the pace that they would actually want to race at.
Right. When I was swimming, you know, it was just yardage, yardage, yardage.
Right.
You jump in, with the exception of the warm-up, you're basically blasting every set. You know, there was no distinction between going hard and going easy, and there was no periodization in the training. I mean, the training techniques and the science behind swimming has come so far from my era. But I remember very well, you know, being a freshman at Stanford and watching John Moffitt, like, just decide that he wasn't going to swim that day or wouldn't come to morning workout, or we'd go run stadiums and he's like, yeah, I'm not doing that. And I'm like, who does he think he is? Like, why is he doing it? But of course, he's a good friend of mine now and I love the guy to death. I couldn't understand it and I couldn't see it at the time, but he knew himself well enough. Like, he knew what he needed and he knew that that was not going to advance him towards his goal. And he almost had to, you know, put his foot down, knowing that that was going to make him unpopular, that that was going to make Skip like completely insane, but he didn't care. And the science has now caught up where we recognize, you know, what that's all about. And the, you know, I think Mike Bottom really kind of carried the torch of bringing that philosophy and this sense of self-experimentation and trying new things and being adventuresome in training techniques into the era that is now sort of, you know, become the mainstream thing, right? So when you show up at Cal and Mike's your coach and he sees that there's something special in you, I mean, your original idea was you were only going to swim a year, right? This was just your ticket to get a scholarship.
I thought it was just my ticket into school.
Right.
You know, like, you know, that as a high school student, so much planning revolves around this need that you have to get into college. You know, I was thinking about being accepted into college, you know, for a bulk of the time.
You had a 4.2 GPA, though. You were going to get into college.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know how it works. I didn't feel like I was the smartest person in my school.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was probably like at the bottom end of all of the honor students.
Still
true. Okay. I didn't objectively know how it actually works as well as I do now. But to reel it back a little bit to, I don't want to take credit for something that I think is not due. It's not like if I was deciding, it's like, you know what? Those stadiums aren't for me because I know what's going to make me great. And it wasn't like that. I knew I couldn't do it. I didn't have the heart for it. I didn't have the mind for it. And it was on Mike as a coach who was like, all right, let's find another way.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find another way for you to be a part of it. If that way isn't going to work, let's find another way, as opposed to just coming down on me hard like many a coach would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it would not have worked out between you and Skip at Stanford.
Suffice to say, no.
You would have quit after your freshman year and it would have been done. You know what I mean? And so just for clarity, like, you were a guy who just had a hard time getting up for morning workout. It just wasn't happening. You were getting a reputation for being lazy and, you know, having difficulty with your teammates who were like, come on, man. Like, why aren't you doing this thing? And Mike was able to sit you down and try to craft a way to motivate you, to get you interested and get you excited about the sport. So what was that, do you think?
A lot of it was being able to do things outside of the pool. You know, so if I was late for workout or I couldn't wake up, and that's its whole issue. My insomnia.
Well, hold on. Let's stick a pin in it for a second.
Okay.
Let me just say this. Like, I've had a couple guests on the podcast come in and talk about sleep and how important sleep is and how we shouldn't skimp on sleep. And, you know, athletes, most of all, like, that's where you make your gains, when your body recovers. So the whole notion that swimmers or any athlete should wake up in an ungodly hour and go train and then be exhausted all day and then go back, it doesn't make sense. It's like the young doctors in residency who work 48-hour shifts. Like, their performance is not benefit. You know, they're not benefiting performance-wise from that.
No.
So it's just one of those things where it's like, well, that's what we do. That's how it's always been done.
But that amount of stress, I think it does harden you into a particular kind of machine. And doctor friends of mine, we'll talk about it that way.
It's
that
a
they're
fair
just,
point.
You know, they're just executing equations over and over again based off of symptom and blah blah blah. It's not. The performance doesn't need to be that high. They just need to know it really, really well. And I think that stress test of trial by fire, of going through that kind of a thing, is what makes them capable of doing it.
But do you think that I'm just trying to imagine, like, all right, so you have a goal, like, I want to be the fastest 50 freestyler in the world. Like, what is going to advance me towards that goal? Is waking up at an ungodly hour every morning to go to the pool in the dark, in the dark and cold?
No.
You know,
there's
a trial by fire aspect to that. And there's a kind of a warrior thing, and there's a camaraderie that happens because you're doing it with other people and you're all kind of suffering collectively. But perhaps that's not the most scientific approach towards maximizing your potential.
It's true. And I think there are different kinds of potentials. You know, I think what works for me to make me like a better sprint swimming, which, you know, the actual value in that, we'll leave that. We won't even discuss that, but I think there is, I do miss out on something. That's what I do believe that, you know, otherwise, why do Navy SEALs do go through the training that they go through?
Yeah, no, I get that.
And why do you do? Why do you have these very strong patterns of behavior to get you to do what you do?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know that I have the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm just different strokes for different folks.
Right. So, all right. Well, back to Mike though. So, what does he do to, you know, incite your interest and get you excited about the sport?
Right. Right. So, it could be anything from, you know, it was university. So the idea of research, you know, we'd pop in tapes of all the greats through the years and what they did, what made them great, trying to like see it. It's like, if he can make me see it in somebody else, then maybe I can start detecting more things in how I work on them myself. So watching tapes of Olympic champions and where to be soon be future competitors, and start to emulate, you know, that idea of like fake it till you make it. Well, I was doing that where I was like faking all these elements or imitating aspects of technique that all these great swimmers had. And so it kind of all just melded together into what became me and what ultimately put me on the podium. So, and Mike was into that, but it was more so that just there was a partnership there. And I would constantly test with him whether he cares about my swimming or he cares about me.
How did you test him?
Oh, all the time. Not showing up to work out, you know, just all kinds of poor choices when he is, you know, he was largely like my caretaker. If I, you know, in lieu of parents in the college environment, you know, he was the one who felt responsible for me. The whole battery of poor choices I made, you know, he had to be there and deal with me afterwards. And hopefully, try to steer me into healthier development so I didn't need to hit a rock bottom, even if I fell down a few really deep wells.
And how does that start to pay dividends? Like, how quickly are you starting to see results?
Dual meet season, my freshman year. You know, I was just working on technique and, you know, under his watch when I showed up, and then I went away to training camp. And in training camp, it's not like I was always choosing before that to miss workouts. I couldn't help it. But in a training camp environment, you go along with the crew. You have less freedom. And due to that lack of freedom, you know, I just fall in line with the discipline. It isn't hard. It's much harder to be disciplined and focused when you have a lot more going on. So, got through training camp, went to my first dual meet, and, you know, broke 20 for the first time.
Right.
Which, you know, for swimming, that's kind of a barrier that every sprinter looks at some point.
Right. But it's interesting that you didn't break 20 until you got to Cal, right?
Which But in those days, I think there had only been one or two.
In a dual meet, like unshaven.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, unshaven, everything. Yeah, I did it.
Right.
And that's when some of my other teammates who would kind of didn't get me, and kind of had brushed me off as someone who's just going to wash out, to be like, what's going on here?
Right.
Yeah.
There's something more happening.
I mean,
at that time, did you aspire to be an Olympic swimmer? I mean, was that entering your mindset as anything that you thought you were capable of pulling off?
No, definitely not. You know, it was a dream, you know, when I was a kid, and that dream had kind of faded out in high school where, you know, it, it, it was a pipe dream. It didn't seem realistic in any kind of manner. Mm-hmm. And even as I started building up and developing and making these huge breakthroughs that first college season, it wasn't until I went to national college championships and broke a world record and won the 100 freestyle as well that,
right,
you know, it's like, maybe I do have a chance.
Yeah, you broke a world record. I think you might, right?
Well, short course meters, you know. So
yeah, I know. In swimming, you know, the short course meters records are a little softer.
They are a little softer.
But still, a world record's a world record, right? I feel like the thing that it seems, you know, from reading the book and like kind of reading in between the lines, the thing that really seems to motivate you beyond everything else is the camaraderie with your teammates. Like that really exceeds your own personal kind of vainglory over the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't like to and don't want to do any of this alone. You know, like when it was in high school and before, it was my teammates that kept me going when things were rough because they were my friends. You know, I wasn't just a tool, some larger goal, you know, but we went through things together and, you know, we hung out together. And in college, it was the same thing. You know, I mean, after the Olympics, you know, I had I had one more good year in me in 2001. Mm-hmm. And then I was mentally, motivationally checked out.
Right.
I was looking at other things, but I still had another 2 years of eligibility.
Right.
But I made it through that and performed pretty dang well considering my heart wasn't fully invested, but for the team.
Right. Well, there was a moment where you could have gone pro after the Olympics and made a bunch of cash, but you would have had to give up your eligibility, and being a member of that team was more important to you at that time, it was an amazing choice that you made.
Well, I was motivated more by being with them than trying to be outside of them as this professional swimmer.
Mm-hmm. All right, and we're going to get there, but we're working our way up towards your first Olympics. I feel like everything came into focus when you went to that training camp and started training with Gary Hall and these other great sprinters. Like
That's
everything
right.
kind of snapped into focus for you. I mean, what was it like meeting Gary for the first time? It's almost like you're meeting your match in terms of rebellious sprinter.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's like your doppelganger in certain ways.
Yeah, he was the exemplar, and he was from whom we all trickled down from. I didn't even know who Gary was really before I got to college. I don't even really remember watching the '96 Olympics because I was so kind of tuned out of the competitive
That's
element
in its own right.
Yeah. You know, and
so you weren't like the kid who had pictures from Swimming World magazine like all over your wall and all that kind of stuff.
No, I remember pouring through it in '88 when Biondi, you know, because Biondi is the one that sparked the Olympic dream in me.
It is. He is.
Yeah. And, you know, and I followed a lot of '92 in Barcelona. And then in '96, it was kind of like I was losing I had lost my edge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't wrapped up in that world.
Mm-hmm. Biondi now teaches up at Sierra Canyon School. Are you still in touch with him?
Dude, I see him every once in a while. Like, I saw him at Masters Nationals the last time. I've seen him give a couple talks, and it's funny because, you know, like, I am just like, eyes just like bugged out, just like, wow, you know, his story's so good. And I look around, you know, and it's a bunch of like teens who are the ones that are really supposed to be soaking it in. They're just like yawning and like they just don't get it. They don't get it. It's a different time of what it meant to be a swimmer or be left as a swimmer compared to other athletes.
It's so true.
It's changed so much.
I went and spoke at Sierra Canyon last week, and I've never met Matt in person. I mean, I've met him, like, we swam in the same era, so I've met him in passing, but I don't really know him. And I was up there to speak to the kids. And he wasn't there that day. He was gone. I was so bummed. But I was like, you guys, do you understand? Like, who is your teacher? Do you know what he did? Did you get the gravity of his accomplishments? Or like, whatever.
Yeah, you know? Right. To think that he spent like a couple decades teaching math to middle school kids in Hawaii.
I know, right? It's cool. Yeah. All right. So you hit this training camp in Phoenix, right? Tucson? Or Phoenix?
No, Phoenix. Tempe.
Right. And it's you and essentially like some of the top sprinters in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So we anointed ourselves the Dirty Dozen. And we had Olympians. We had a handful from South America. One of them was a former world champion. And the Polish All-Stars, who would be future European champions, and then a handful of guys from Cal who are Americans.
Right. And this was your prep leading up to Olympic trials in 2000.
That's right.
Right. And so, what did you learn from these guys?
You know, I learned the most from John Olson. You know, he kind of took me under his wing. He felt like, I think he kind of recognized that, you know, he had done his best and he was, you know, it was his swan song. And so he wanted to pass off as much wisdom as he can. Or maybe, you know, that's just what you do when you get older. But he taught me a lot about just negotiating the highs. That was the harder part, is negotiating the highs of performing well, of not letting it get too spun out of control and staying focused on my task and, you know, and just accepting me in that kind of environment where, you know, a lot of those guys were still very much train hard all the time. You know, don't be a bitch. Right.
But it's still a swim hard, you know, party hard crew.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody has a problem partying hard.
Yeah. Especially Gary.
Well, he wouldn't party with us. You know, he was a little older and he had just made it through some of his own struggles.
Right. With type 1 diabetes.
Type 1 diabetes. And then, you know, he failed a drug test for marijuana.
Oh, so, yeah. I remember that.
Wow. Yeah. So that's what made him the bad boy.
Right.
Was that he had failed that test. And, you know, so he was kind of like scorched earth in the swimming world because of that. And my, how times have changed, you know, like
right.
what they look at now. But yeah, you know, Gary, I didn't see him come in that often. So it was like, I was being able to look at myself the way others viewed me sometimes and be like, man,
that's interesting.
I'm so tired. And then he just waltzes in after not showing up this morning and just drops a bomb, you know, like mm-hmm. grab a kickboard, do 100 meter long course and like 105, mm-hmm. you know, like something really fast, just be like, dang, you know, so to kind of see that and know that he's doing it his own way and to be kind of like then coached through it by Mike to be like, you know, Gary does his thing. That's how he does it. It's what makes him great, you know, and you know, cause it would be easy to be prone to like jealousy to know that, this person could be that great without doing as much as you believe needs
right.
to be done.
And Mike understanding that every swimmer has their own specific needs and trying to enter into that partnership with mm-hmm. all of them and meet them where they're at and try to provide them with what they need to be their best, as opposed to what most coaches do, which is like, this is the program. You're either with me or you're against me and
right.
there's no negotiation.
Yeah. And I'm learning the most about this now, you know, mm-hmm. as I enter into a world where I do some coaching, and at the top level, man, ego. The coach's ego becomes like the most massive obstacle to navigate.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. So going into trials, like, did you believe that you were in contention for a spot? Like, what's the thinking?
I did. I believed if I did everything right, I had a legitimate chance to get on that relay.
Mm-hmm. And so you get second at trials, right?
Well, I got fifth in the 100. So that put me on the relay, which is kind of like a,
right.
whew, mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of the monkeys
pressure
off my
release,
back.
You're on the team.
Yeah. I know I'm going to the Olympics. And then I fired off a great 50 and got second. And so I knew I was going to compete in an individual event as well.
Mm-hmm. And what is that feeling when you know you're going to the Olympics? That's crazy. You know, like to go from really it only like 2-3 years prior to that, it not even being in your head that would be a possibility.
No. Yeah, no, it's, and actually, I'll chime in here and be that there was a seed of a toxic seed of entitlement that was planted mm-hmm. at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew I was going
in
and I knew.
In what way?
Well, you know, I believed since I was going to be on this relay that I was going to win a gold medal no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. had won that relay ever since it had been a part of the Olympic Games. So there was a legacy, there was a tradition, and, you know, I was going to be a part of it.
Right. And so you show up in Sydney, we'll talk about the relay first. The Australians are the number two relay in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Gary makes an impolitic remark to the media that the Americans were going to crush the Australians. They're going to smash them like guitars, right?
Right.
And that I remember that because that set off like a media maelstrom in the wake of that.
It did. And they totally stripped that bit out of context.
What was the full sentiment?
Well, he said that like they're enormously talented. They're going to be a super fast team. It's going to be competitive, but at the end, we're going to smash them like guitars.
Right.
So he totally paid homage to them leading up to, no, but we're going to win.
Right.
Wasn't so, like he just came out and said like, we smashed them.
Uh-huh. It's kind of like when one of Michael Phelps's competitors, you know, talks a little smack. All that does is put fuel, you know, fuel on the fire.
Oh, with Michael, like
the worst possible thing that you could do, mm-hmm. right? So this incites the Australians, and so this is quite the showdown. So walk us through like how that relay went down.
Well, in prelims, you know, without Gary and Neil, our two best guys, we were, you know, a fraction of a second off the world record. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew at that point, it's like, well, not only are we going to win a gold medal, we're going to break a world record too. This is going to be incredible. And at night we go out, march out in front of, you know, however many thousands of Australians mostly. And
in Sydney, in the home house.
In the home house. And swimming over there is, you know, like basketball or football over here.
Right.
It's really their sport. And
this was the era of Ian Thorpe and, mm-hmm. you know, swimming had never been bigger.
No. Yeah. He was, how old was he? Was he 16 at the time or 17?
I don't remember.
Just, yeah, it was crazy. I remember we were driving through downtown and there was a skyscraper and probably the first like 15 to 20 floors of it, like every glass window of that floor, it made up a giant, just like from the chest up of Ian Thorpe, just his head. For like 20, 25 floors of a skyscraper. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
Like this Michael, is swimming
like
in Australia.
Michael Jordan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was all put on his shoulders before he'd even, before he'd even won an Olympic gold. So we march out and, you know, they announce the U.S. and there's a few cheers and they announce Australia and like the place just roared. And being that I was so inexperienced, I'd never been to an international meet before. I didn't even have a passport before I made the Olympic team. That, you know, as soon as it got quiet, I stood up on the blocks. Stood up on the blocks, getting ready to start. And I hear a referee go, lane floor four, please step down. And at that point, I actually look around, you know, instead of just the lane in front of me, I know it's like there's nobody else ready. Uh-huh. Everybody else is just standing at the side. And, you know, it turns out this is where you have to wait for this long whistle before you stand up. So I'm like a goon up there and I step down and then they call us back up. We take our mark and they set us off and I dive in, you know, and I'm pumping my underwaters just like as fast as I can. And I couldn't help it. I squeeze a look next to me, you know, sometimes you just have to look and I see Michael Klim. One kick after another, just surging ahead of me to the point where we actually break to the surface of the water. He's got a full body length. Mm. I'm crushed. And I lose sight of my game plan. And I spin my wheels to catch him. And I catch him at the turn, the halfway point. But I'd used too much. Mm-hmm. So on the way back, I started fading. And gradually, I'm falling further and further back until I'm at his feet and even a little bit before. And I touched the wall for the exchange. And, you know, Australia has a formidable lead. Michael Klim had broken the world record leading off the relay. And, you know, I'm just like completely wrung out. And I climb out, just the lactic acid pouring through, you know, every single muscle. And I watch, and it's like a broken record as every American sprints to catch the Australian and pass him, only to fade right at the end as for the next exchange. Neil Walker did the same thing, then Jason Lezak, and then it was Gary Hall Jr. and Ian Thorpe. And Gary has the lead on him. He takes the lead early. And coming back, Ian's catching him inch by inch, or as it were, centimeter by centimeter, since we're in Australia.
Right.
And so with 5 meters to go, with two more strokes, he overtakes him and touches. The Australians win. 12, 15,000 people roar in triumph. You know, the Australian swimmers stand up on their blocks and start playing air guitars.
Yeah. That image of them playing air guitar.
You still find that one, right?
Yeah.
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 And we were just, I was just devastated because I thought that was what was going to get me to the podium.
Mm-hmm. And so in the wake of that, how do you get it together to get ready for the 50?
Well, I isolated myself a ton. You know, even going by media at that point, I didn't trust myself to say anything. So I kind of just stood back of my teammates, quietly, just breathing in and breathing out. And, you know, knowing that having not done it there and being a little too immature to understand, you know, that I was still part of a great thing, that I had one more opportunity. So the blinders went on, and I really felt that I had let what somebody else had done get to me. Mm-hmm. I had let somebody else's performance in a sport where you don't need to, it's not like boxing or tennis where you need to figure out a way past your opponent, you know, mano a mano. This is just a race. Mm-hmm. You know, what you do is all you. And any, if somebody else gets in that, that's your failure, not their success.
Right.
So I just started going through it in my head, you know, hour by hour, day by day for a handful of days, just of what could go wrong, what could go right, and every possible permutation, of what could happen. And so by the time I actually got to my individual event and I stood up on those blocks, I don't even like remember the race.
Right.
You know, it just, I stood up, I took my mark. The race happened, which was just an execution of everything that I was ready for. And I opened myself up to just swimming free.
do you have some kind of specific like visioning preparation that you do? Like what's the ritual?
Like ready room ritual?
Yeah.
It's really just, it's attunement and control of the body. You know, with a shave and a taper, you know, there's, your nervous system is just like on fire. It wants to go. And it's about being like, just for me, it was always about trying to just be aware of it, but not, don't let it out. Mm-hmm. Don't let it out yet. So you feel every heartbeat, you know, you feel, you know, if you're sitting, your forearms against your legs, if your heels are touching, you feel that, you know, if the air conditioner is blowing on your head, you feel that too. And you feel it all at once. And you just being in that state, just moment to moment to moment to moment. Mm-hmm. And it's very, you know, and then it's, there's idiosyncratic of how you proceed from that room to behind the blocks to on the blocks to taking your marks.
And when you're behind the blocks right before the 50, are you looking around at the other guys or you're just staring down the end of the lane?
Staring down the lane.
And is Gary like wearing his like, you know, Muhammad, doing his Muhammad Ali routine in the boxing shorts and all of that?
I know he did it.
Uh-huh. But you didn't see it.
But I didn't see it.
Right.
Didn't see it. There was no space for anybody else at that uh-huh. point.
Everything shut out.
Everything shut out.
Uh-huh. And then you just, I mean, it's almost like a fugue state. Like the, you know, you're so programmed to go that you're just expressing what's already happened inside of you.
Right.
Right. And you touch, how long before you know what had happened?
As long as it took me to squint my nearsighted eyes and make out the one next to my name, and I saw simultaneously another one next to Gary's.
And it's funny because you guys had joked about tying at the Olympics, right?
It was one of those situations I had actually imagined. I was like, well, what if we tied?
Right.
You know, and other teammates that were there for other countries, I'd done the same for them.
It's so crazy. So what is it? What's the, you know, what do you feel like when you've won an Olympic gold medal? Like, what is that like?
Well, you know, you have a fist pump, you're stoked and you're super happy. And, you know, Gary was there and Bart was there. And, you know, it was just being able to hug over the landlines, you know, it was great. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the best part of that.
And what happens next, I feel like really ushers in the next phase of your life, right? Like what happens like immediately next kind of cracks the door open to what ultimately, you know, becomes a very confusing time for you.
So I'm beaming and I'm walking down the pool to media, and the media guy is Jim Gray. He puts the mic in my face and he says, "So I noticed you twitching behind the blocks. Was that your Tourette's?" Mm-hmm. And I am just stunned because I thought that was something I kept buried real close, that, that nobody publicly, there was no public knowledge of my Tourette's, and I froze. deer in the headlights. I couldn't say anything as it started going through my head at a million miles an hour. What are people going to think based off of what I say? I have not prepared to answer this question whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's that cold stare of the camera just right on you.
Knowing that millions of people are watching.
Yeah.
It's live, right?
It's live.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So you don't say anything.
I don't say anything. I don't say anything until, you know, there's a painful, you know, almost 10, 15, 20, I don't know how long it was. It was excruciating though. And then,
that's such an uncool thing to ask you. I mean, like of all the things that he could have asked you.
I mean, yeah. And it was, I don't even know how he got that knowledge, you know? Like a lot of my teammates didn't even really know about that. And
well, let's talk about it a little bit. You know, it's something sure. that you've, you know, dealt with for most of your life. It kind of started to manifest around junior high, right?
Right.
With your eye twitching. I mean, tell me what happened.
Well, in essence, I would be losing control of my body for bits and periods of time. So, my primary symptom was like my eyes would just like flutter. Mm-hmm. And while they would continue to blink for these, they're short fits, you know, they would last for, you know, 3-5 seconds, not very long, but I couldn't do anything while that was happening and it would interrupt anything that was going on. So right. if I was reading, I lose my place reading. You know, if I was supposed to be working on a math problem and I was going through the calculus in my head, I would forget it and have to start over from the beginning. And it was happening just like frequently. Like every 30 seconds, you know, 3 seconds was lost to me and I'd have to start over again. And, only through taking like a bunch of these, there are these hypertension pills. I'd always call them tranquilizers because I'd take them and they just knock me out, just completely put me out, asleep at night, during the day, in class, whatever it may be, just to try to keep those tapped down so that I can go through days semi-normal and get some things done.
And it was causing like social problems for you at school, right? Like people
for sure.
knew, kids knew what was going on.
And you can't really hide it if you're just like blinking uncontrollably, you
right.
know, and, at school, you know, a lot of my friends or a lot of like, you know, what would be the social group, they didn't know what it was. And it wasn't that like they weren't outright malicious or anything like that, but they retreated from me. Mm-hmm. And then I started to become comfortable just like being on my own because I wouldn't have to deal with the stairs and
when you're at swim practice and
you're underwater,
it can bug you.
It wouldn't bug me. And then there was something about, putting in that effort that it would hold the Tourette's at bay.
Interesting.
Like think using the energy, putting my nervous system to work provided an outlet so it didn't need to lash out in its own way.
Uh-huh. Well, most people are familiar with Tourette's because of, you know, the idea that you spontaneously burst into profanity, right? Mm-hmm. But it's
I do
much
that
more.
Too.
You do that?
I do. I do it and sometimes it's just yells, you know, right. when I get excited and yeah, and it comes sharp. There's no like build up to it. It's just like bah!
And you're just really are you yeah. completely unconsciously aware of it happening?
No. I know it's there and I try to direct it. You know, you can't
can you
fully
feel it
control
coming?
It, but you can be in the driver's seat. That's what I've learned through
you
the years.
You can feel it coming on. Do you know like when you're headed towards?
Yeah. Well, it's now that I'm older and I mean, I still exhibit symptoms to me and only if you like have it or you have experience with it, would you be able to identify them as I'm sitting across right. from you.
And it's a neurological disorder, right? But
yeah.
from what I can tell, they're still not really sure what causes it. Or, I mean, you have these
they
meds
don't.
That can kind of clamp down on it, but there's no cure for it.
No.
Right?
No. And fortunately, you know, my neurologist said that I would grow out of it eventually. And it's not that I grew out of it, but I grew into it. Mm-hmm. You know, I learned how to be it without it like completely ruining me. Mm-hmm. So, and an environment has so much to do with it, you know? So if I put myself in the very excited environment, then it comes out more. And through the years, I have learned to, you know, in fact, like use it to my advantage.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an interesting thing that I read about in your book that I was not aware of. You talk about how Oliver Sacks did these experiments and started to figure out that there's this bizarre relationship between Tourette's and speed and performance, which is really kind of fascinating, right? So you have this history of taking these meds to prevent you from having these outbursts. But then as you get into college, you start experimenting with going off your meds right before a big meet.
Right.
So it's almost like a reverse performance enhancer going off, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, could you feel it? Like, what is that? Is that like a palpable thing that you could tell the difference when you're
when
off
I was
the meds?
Off the meds? Yeah. Oh yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And is there truth in that, you think, that like your speed, your ability to be a sprinter is related somehow to having Tourette's?
I think that, I mean, yes, but it's more that through so much of trying to fight off this outburst of energy, of trying to keep it in check, it's like, you know, you're trying to stare down yourself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, eventually you buckle. But that really lent itself to handling the excess of energy that everybody deals with when they're tapered. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and I see people do it all the time. Like they're tapered, they're excited, and they start just doing things with their body that they shouldn't be. They should be trying to like hold it in, save it for the actual performance.
Right. And for people that are listening that aren't familiar with what taper is, basically, you just destroy your body for 6 or 9 months or however long. And then you go through what's called a taper where you refine your training, you back off the volume and the intensity, your body is repairing itself. And suddenly you find yourself in this state where you have literally like boundless energy. And I remember being at meets and just, you know, that's just a recipe for disaster with swimmers. They want, you know, they want to get into trouble. They can't sit still. They're like, you know, destroying hotel rooms and all kinds of stuff. Right. Cause you just, you have all this pent up energy that is meant to be directed, to your performances in a meet, but sometimes you can't contain it.
Yeah. And so I think that's where the Tourette's became an asset. It was that it was training me to control that, before I needed to use that in some kind of way in the future. You know, I talked about this with a friend before. This idea of super compensation, and the human body is incredible like that, where you can like beat it down. And then as soon as you stop beating it down, it'll continue to repair itself at the rate that it was in order to survive going into it and to keep going at that heightened sense. You know, it's the same kind of thing that leads a tapered athlete to outperform what his body should have been able to. But it's also the same reason why if a serious alcoholic quits cold turkey, he gets a seizure.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's I've never thought of it that way. That's so true, though. It's super interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So you get blindsided with this Tourette's question.
Yeah.
And you go blank. And then it's followed up with a second question.
Yeah.
Right. And what's the second question?
Loosely is, so what's it like to be black and win a gold medal?
Mm-hmm. Another question you were unprepared for.
Yeah. I'd heard it a couple of times. You know, they phrase it as African American descent.
Mm-hmm.
And I am, but it's not like, and swimming being so very visual, it's just a body.
And also very white.
And very, very white. And very, very white. That is, I'm standing there with, you know, this golden tan that when I stay out of the sun, you know, I'm as pale as anybody, as any, Scandinavian. And then to try to convince an audience out there that I'm black, and that you should listen to me.
Which was never anything that you had any interest in doing, and now it's being foisted upon you.
Exactly.
Right.
This mantle is being thrust on me by...
This is an interesting narrative. This is a narrative that's going to get people to click on a link or continue to watch or to read.
Right. So being so young and being in that kind of a situation, you know, if you don't have your own story and control of your own story, a story will be created for you. And it just so happens these old white men... were the ones that were writing the story about me because I didn't have one yet.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back to this duality in the book. The differentiation between being in control of your own identity and having that identity foisted upon you. So suddenly you're the first, you know, person of African American descent to ever win a gold medal in swimming.
Well, and American.
American, right.
United States, yeah.
Right, right. Oh, because there was... Anthony Nesty?
Yeah.
Anthony Nesty, right, from Suriname. And you don't look black, but your father's black.
Right.
Your mother's Jewish. Mm-hmm. And you must, on some level, have been expecting this? I mean, was that not?
Yeah, I'd been asked once or twice about it. Yeah, but I also was not expecting to win an individual gold medal.
Right.
And all of a sudden be like, winning a gold medal, that is a dream. Nowhere in there did I even consider that I then had to represent something because of it.
Mm-hmm.
For me, growing up with that dream, it was just about racing as fast as I can, faster than anybody. There was no effect. I didn't even think about what the effect would be, especially in a social manner.
And so what was the effect? I mean, this interview really, you know, sends you into a bit of a prolonged tailspin, really. I mean, it has profound impact on, you know, the next 10 years of your life, from what I can
gather. Does it?
I think it does. Would you disagree with that? I mean, it's not this guy's fault. Some, you know, those questions were going to get
right
asked of you by
of course,
somebody at some
you know,
point.
I don't blame him, you know, but it certainly through the years I have since, like, you know, formulated ideas on media as an entity,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how it operates and how it must, and, you know, the people that are part of it, you know, they're still people, you know, like they're just doing what they do. But, you know, media is like capital, you know, mm-hmm. it's a devouring beast. So if
yes.
you don't find a way to feed the beast, it'll just eat you.
That's super true.
So here I am parceling out a little bit of feed.
And I guess I'm the media, you know, yeah. I don't really consider myself media, but for better or worse, I suppose.
Well, I chose you, right?
Right. Yeah, you did. Yeah. So you're in control of your identity now.
Yeah. Well, at least I'd like to think so.
So you continue to swim for a couple of years after this. And in mm-hmm. fact, you put in some pretty amazing performances. You perform in a stellar fashion at the World Championships, mm-hmm. like 2 years later, right? You're swimming faster than ever. But your interest and your enthusiasm and your excitement about your identity as a swimmer starts to wane. Like, you're performing almost in despite yourself and your behavior.
Right. I'm performing and I'm racing because I enjoy it. And, you know, it became, having met my ultimate goal, then my next challenge was, not as noble, or it was like, well, how much can I fuck this up and continue to succeed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I kind of went down that path a little bit because, and a lot, there was this tension, this cognitive dissonance between who I thought I was or who I wanted to be internally and who I was meant to be versus this constructed public image mm-hmm. of who Anthony Irvin the swimmer was.
Mm-hmm.
And they were at odds with each other. And now, knowing now, you know, like that was all on me. I could have done with that whatever I wanted. Instead, I kind of dipped flight and ran away mm-hmm. from it.
Yeah. And that fine line between kind of the quest for, you know, discovering what that identity is for yourself and the self-destruction aspect of that. Mm. It's almost like on some level you had to burn the house down to begin to figure out, you know, who that person is for you.
Right, right. I always liked that Latin phrase, tabula rasa,
mm-hmm.
you know, the blank slate, you know, because nobody ever really has a blank slate. And, you know, I tried my best to create one for myself. But everybody's thrown into this universe with some kind of past, history, their family. And as a child, you know, you do things that aren't necessarily your choices. And you know, there's a certain momentum to everything. And a lot of times, your choices are just about steering in a particular direction or not. But you can't really change directions.
Right. And, you know, swimming is kind of a bro culture, you know, in a lot of ways, right? And
yeah.
I had, you know, Aaron Pearsall on the podcast, and we talked about this a little bit because, you know, he's very much a soul surfer guy who, you know, he's not of that ethos at all. And you're not either. Like, you're very, you're very introspective, you know, sort of bookish, creative, you know, artistic person who's immersed in this culture of, you know, it's kind of a fraternity lifestyle in some respect. And on top of that, you know, the idea that somehow you could transcend this mantle of Olympic gold medalist so that people could see the true Anthony Irvin behind that mask is almost an impossible ask of somebody, right? So in order to do that, you had to blow everything up.
Blew it all up. Yeah, yeah.
So drugs, motorcycles, drinking, rock and roll, women.
Yeah. I tried to do it all.
I mean, you go from, I don't want to spoil the book and everybody should read it. You know, those are some of my favorite parts of the book is, you know, you grappling with this and like you going to Brooklyn and, you know, getting into a band and you're like cross-dressing at one point, you know, and you're smoking cigarettes and you're popping Oxycontins and you're getting into hallucinogens. And I mean, it goes off the rails, right?
Well,
so how much of this is, you know, part of that can be chalked up to like, in order to figure out who I am, I have to try on all these hats and answer these questions for myself. And how much of that was just pure self-destructive, like, fuck you?
Well, there was no pure destructive fuck you. Oh, there were a few pure moments of self-destruction.
Or just, you know, lack of respect or care for yourself. I mean, you're driving around on your motorcycle like a madman. On some level, it could be contended that, you know, there's a death wish aspect to this.
Yeah.
You know, you're flirting.
But I also believed I knew what I was doing.
Right.
You know, there was
there's the ego component too. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it took considerable work to finally get that ego to collapse. But once it did, you know, then that's when things I really started feeling, I started to become more me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And where does the Zen Buddhism come into it?
Zen Buddhism.
How does that contribute to the path?
That actually came in relatively early, right after winning the gold medal, because obviously I had a bunch of people asking, it's like, well, what's it like? How do you get to that place? And as I, you know, like circling around trying to describe what that feeling would be like, it eventually came to me that, it would be like Buddhism. Oh, wait, no, I'm jumping the rails here. That was why it fit, but Zen Buddhism actually came into the picture when I ate a bunch of mushrooms and I completely was like just bonked out seeing cartoons, and it was like too much for me. Like, I didn't freak out or do anything. I was able to kind of channel that inner place and just let everything wash over me for the necessary time until I was back to being just sober, for lack of a better word, though forever changed. And I woke up the next day after finally able to sleep, and I was looked at my ceiling and I was like, man, there's got to be a better way of understanding the universe than doing too many drugs, than tripping out too hard.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever like do DMT or ayahuasca or any of those?
No, I always meant to, and I read a ton about it, but you know, my psychonaut days kind of, they dwindled down and disappeared before that kind of stuff had come my way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So mushrooms, and then.
I woke up that day, walked outside my front door, and saw there was a Zen temple catty corner to my house. And I'm like, wow, it's a sign. So I started going there like every day and just meditating.
And you have some beautiful passages in the book about some of the sort of Zen koans that you start to, you know, play around with. Do you remember any of those?
A few of those were genuinely mine, but you know, Constantine actually, he studied philosophy as an undergraduate at Columbia, and he specialized in Buddhism. So he was able to bring forth a lot of those.
There's nobody else that could have co-written this book with you, by the way. He's like the perfect co-writer for you.
Well, dude, we were hanging out for a few years before I even got back into swimming again. Mm-hmm. You know, and you don't be friends with somebody unless you have some kind of working like foil as a, in conversation.
Right.
Yeah. And understanding.
All right. So you start going to the Zen Buddhist temple and start meditating, right?
Right.
And so what is the impact of that?
Just maintaining a semblance of control of myself.
You know, and this was before you retired in 2003, right?
Yeah. This was in like late 2000, early 2001. You know, so I was attempting to stabilize after all the hoo-ha of the post Olympics. And, you know, like I had a girlfriend and, you know, I was like, okay, I need to stop partying so excessively. And you know, this became a good force of stabilization for me. And it was all mine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was training, doing well, meditating. And, you know, the world championships that summer was in Japan. It was in Fukuoka, you know, a place I'd always wanted to go. And there was arguably least for me, that was like my most successful meet.
Right. Yeah. You said that you thought that was your best performances.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I won the 50 and the 100, you know, an event that nobody really thought I could do.
Mm-hmm. Based on the training that you were putting in leading up to that?
I think it was just my preparedness and my confidence. And yeah, just, I think I had all the right habits that year to have gotten that kind of result.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I feel like at the same time, there's still this encroaching dismantling that's kind of creeping up on you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that I talk about on the podcast a lot is, you know, I've gone through my own dismantling, and mm-hmm. I know a lot of people that have, and you always want to sort of, if you're peering in on someone else's life who's going through something like that, you always want to reach in and save them or help them.
Mm.
But, you know, one of the things that we always say is, you know, don't deprive them of, you know, the beauty of that moment, because there's a rebirth that can happen that comes with that level of self-understanding that is in development. Right. And I feel like that's something that you are experiencing at that time, you know, or approaching at that time. And in no small part due to this struggle with ego that was precipitated by becoming an overnight superstar, right? Because I don't think swimming is very unique, because there are very few other sports that go from basic, like, anonymity on a mainstream level to the white hot spotlight of the Olympics and then back to anonymity, right? So you live your life training and doing what you do, and you're winning races along the way, but it's not until the Olympics and all the world is watching where it's almost like a switch gets flicked and everything's different.
Yeah, a switch gets flicked, everything's different for you. And as well, it's like you give birth to a bunch of little swimmers around the world.
Yeah. Well, and the responsibility that comes with that, the mantle that you have to carry with that. I mean, what do you think people don't understand about what that experience is like?
I don't know. It's largely that achieving some ultimate goal you spend, you know, your whole known life pursuing, is accomplishing it is nothing like what you dream it would be. The actuality, mm-hmm. the reality is just so much more. It completely eclipses what you thought it was going to be,
because it's so destination focused.
It
right?
is
for so many years, everything is ramping up to mm-hmm. this one day. And you know, as you know, I'm sure you know, it's about. And I know what you appreciate now. It's that it's the journey. You know, it's the it's the camaraderie with the teammates. It's the experience that goes into getting to that day that carries the value, not the destination itself. But when you're kind of compelled to put all this emphasis and focus on that one day to mm-hmm. then realize that didn't fill whatever hole you were trying to fill that drove you to that day is, I would imagine, you know, very destabilizing and confusing. And I think it's Absolutely. Something that a lot of athletes deal with, especially athletes in, you know, in retirement, in early retirement.
Well, on one hand, I think that you almost want to tell yourself to not think too far past that goal, because that goal is so meaningful that looking beyond it can somehow jinx you
mm-hmm.
Of getting to it. And that was something I certainly experienced, like with that relay, you know, that sense of entitlement of that. You know, you want to go into that kind of pursuit where nothing else matters, nothing else should get in the way. So you even sacrifice, what you anticipate to be in order so that you can get there mm-hmm. in reality.
And to be competitive at that level, you almost can't allow any external thought about what comes after to enter your consciousness.
Because that becomes a distraction.
Yeah, it becomes a distraction. So in some level, it can be argued that it cripples you from becoming an actualized human being by its very nature.
Ultimate achievement? Yeah.
Yeah, or just being, you know, to be that driven on one specific thing.
Right.
You know, whether you're an athlete or anything else, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily healthy. I thought it made me sick. But, you know, I've grown acquainted with these ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
That's just part of my life.
Right. And we're going to get into what drives you now. let's dig the hole all the way to the bottom first.
Right.
So, all right. So in 2003, it's like you're done, right?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
I mean, was there
without motivation?
Was it a, did you creep up to that point or did you just wake up one day and just, you know, I'm done with this. It's over with.
No, it was creeping. It was creeping for a while. It was, yeah, I didn't know why I was doing it anymore. I had no more goals left. And the distractions seemed so much better than the training.
Well, it's such a monk-like existence. Maybe not for you in comparison to most swimmers, because you seem to be able to live like a pretty social life in comparison to maybe the guy who's training for the 1500.
Right.
But, but still, you know, you have to live, you know, a very, monastic life. And so the temptation of just being normal again.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was younger, it was enough to be driven by the ambition to tolerate the process. But without the ambition, the goal being gone, then like, what's the process for? Mm-hmm. You know, I was too immature to understand, you know, what it would ultimately become about as I grew older.
So what was the plan?
Yeah. I was like, oh, I'm going to be a rock star.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, had you been playing music all along?
I started playing like in 2003. I started teaching myself guitar and stuff. But really that was just this spontaneous well of emotion to try to express something that I was unable to. Mm-hmm. And I felt that with music, with the artists that I liked, that they were able to do that.
Who were your guys?
Oh man. Well, certainly I was learning. I learned guitar through Jack White and the White Stripes. You know, growing up, Smashing Pumpkins was like my favorite band. So his existential angst was like, I get you, man. You get me. And so without knowing any of the details or knowing any of the ideas that actually went into that, I felt that that was the medium because it takes you into the moment. I feel like music is so temporal like that. It brings you into the moment. You feel something in the moment and then it can pass on.
Mm-hmm. When does it become like a thing? Like you're going to be in a band and you're going to pursue the rock and roll dream?
Oh, right away.
Yeah.
You know,
So you're still in Berkeley at this point. This is before you go to New York.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Still in Berkeley for a few more years, just, working odd jobs for very short periods of time before I get fired. And I'm just like, you know, I'm in a band with friends, you know, some of them.
Was that Weapons of Mass Destruction?
Yeah. Or, the Weapons of Mass Destruction.
That's so awesome.
It was such a joke.
It's, you know, it's like a thrasher band name, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, we were just like, we definitely channeled a lot of like Rage Against the Machine and, but it was super fun. You know, I look back on those times so fondly because we didn't care about like anything. We just wanted to rock and have a good time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was doing that for a while and, you know, and it built up and we were getting better and better. You know, we even started playing gigs and then it's like, it fell apart. And I was like, felt like I was like back at square one. We were a band without a singer and, you know, like, where is this going? I'd run out of money. I was like selling off my possessions at this point, to sustain my lifestyle. And then I was just like, you know what? Time to go a wandering.
Right. And what's mom saying?
Okay. My mom largely wouldn't even talk to me at this point.
Did it break her heart when you retired in 2003?
It did. Yeah. And she totally was, you know, but she would just kept telling me, she's like, just stick with it. You can save enough money to buy a house. And I'm like, what the hell do I want a house for, mom? Mm-hmm. You think I want to be a grown up?
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll.
And so what inspired you to move to New York?
Well, I had, just through word of mouth, you know, I had gone to the Florida Keys to do some like coaching with Gary Hall's, like the whole race club.
With the race club.
Yeah. Uh-huh. They had set up down there. And one of the people that I worked with, you know, went back to New York from this camp and told her coach there, her master's coach. And so about having worked with me. And so he called me up and was like, oh, you know, there's, I do this like triathlete camp in Curacao, you know, it's in the Caribbean, in like January for like a week. You know, would you come be my assistant coach? And I was like, I've got nothing going on.
Right.
So why don't I go? And the guy, you know, just that New York mentality was it. It was inspiring right away, just to see how sharp he moved and talked. And it was very familiar because my mom has a ton of that because she's from New York. And I never really knew what that was. I didn't know anybody else from New York at the time. Hadn't met anybody through the course of my life, actually. And so, you know, in an effort to try to both unlock that maternal side of my history, because my mom doesn't talk about her past really at all. And needing a job and my friend being out there having started a swim school that I had a job if I went and I can just do further exploring. So I was just packed a bag, grabbed a guitar and went.
Right. And, so it starts in Curacao, but then you find yourself kind of couch surfing through Manhattan and Brooklyn for how long were you there?
I was there for a year initially. And then, after that first year, I made it through all four seasons. And then I kind of had discovered what my glass ceiling was, and that I wanted to go back to school and actually get my degree.
New York can kind of bring you to your knees that way.
I didn't feel like it brought me to my knees. It's like I saw what I was capable of doing, knowing myself as well as I did, and I said that's not enough. So,
in what way? Like, what's not enough?
What I thought I would be if I stayed.
If you stayed there,
yeah, because I don't know if New York, given where I was, if New York was the place I knew I wanted to continue to grow. It was a great place to like be a 20-something-year-old hipster, you know, with, you know, who treated his time cheaply and just wanted to have fun and socialize, you know, really trying to fill in that blank slate. But knowing that being goal-oriented does have tons of value. And for that, I wanted to go back to school.
Right.
I figured out what I'd actually study, how I'd make good use of that time.
But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like what triggered that, in many ways was you starting to work with kids and in the pool and starting to experience, you know, kids learning how to swim and just the joy that they have at that level, like helped instill in you, like sort of a childlike, sense of appreciation for the sport and for your life. And that seemed to ground you in a, you know, in a city that can be very ungrounding.
It did. And those were some growing pains of my own in New York. Cause I initially felt like I had no idea what I was doing when I was teaching these kids. I was so afraid and uncomfortable. There was really a lot of doubt if I was effective at this or if I was going to be, but through time, you know, I got used to it. And then became those reminders of a time gone your way back when I was a kid and I actually would play in the water and enjoy it. Cause that's how it started. And somewhere through the competitive ringer and, the relentless pursuit of achievement, I had lost that sense of play, or, you know, it had been just buried so deep that I'd forgotten that was where it had all started. So, I mean, and that's absolutely true. And at that point, I had carried a huge chip on my shoulder about swimming for many years. I didn't go anywhere near the water. That was the first time getting back in the water in any capacity since I retired, you know, was to get in to teach these kids.
Right. And you're hanging out in New York City with all these characters and partying and all that. None of these people like really even know that you, that you had this career as a swimmer.
I'd hold that super close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's going on with your kind of grappling with identity and ego and all of that at this time? Like, well, are you settling into some sense of self?
Like, yeah.
In a progressed way?
Yeah. I really enjoyed the chameleon status that I was developing of, you know, like being able to fit in somewhere and, you know, just being Anthony, a regular guy, or Tony, as it were, instead of, you know, because somebody opens their mouth, whether it's me or somebody else, and I'm in a group and they're like, well, he's an Olympic gold medalist. Instantly, everybody's assessment of me changes. And I was done with that. I wanted to leave that behind. So I never brought it up, you know, and it was super liberating. You know, it also, you know, like it showed me like I was behind everybody on any other pursuit that I would want to go after. I was like, very far behind, because obviously everybody's still, they own themselves and they've been working on themselves for a long, long time.
Right,
they didn't deliberately bury it.
Well, they've also been pursuing whatever it is they're interested in, you know, for many years and probably had a more advanced sense of, like, you, in certain ways, like, swimming almost truncates your personal development because you can't really focus on anything else and you don't entertain what you're going to be doing post career as much.
Yeah, it reminds me of a song lyric. I miss me. I miss everything I'll never be. Mm. You know, so after having committed so much to swimming, it was like, now I want to make space to do some of those other things that I'd kind of had to turn away from along the way. Even if it meant that I was going to be just like skill wise, just garbage. And everybody's going to be better than me because I'd be so far behind in the starting line.
Mm-hmm. And then you decide to go back to grad school. I'll study English.
So it wasn't until I'd finished my undergrad, actually. I got my bachelor's in English. You know, I did that in like 2.5 years. Well, a little bit more because I kept going back to New York to live there for a while and then doing school. But yeah, once I actually started graduate school, and that had everything to do with like sports and swimming. And then I really had to start confronting my identity as an athlete and trying to deconstruct it, unpackage it, analyze it, in the context of graduate school. And that's when I largely got back into the water.
So what did you, in that unpacking process, like what did you discover?
Well, so much anger about things, actually. Put it into words on a page, you know, is there's a certain catharsis to that, you know, and
so you start writing about your experiences as a way of,
in an academic way, you know, like where I'd write about things I did and felt and then argumentation for why I may have felt that personally, but then as well as, the environment contributing to that, you know, so using theoretical lenses to try to explain it. You know, and that was a big game changer to me because before that, you know, I was doing music, I was expressing a lot of the same things, but it wasn't in such literal terms of my experiences as an athlete.
Right. You can express anger or energy through music, but not necessarily be in touch with exactly where that's coming from or why.
Right. You're just reaching out. It's like, everybody feels this way. That's why, you know, like I like it and I can identify with it.
Yeah. That's interesting. And so that kind of leads you back into the pool.
Yeah. So yeah, after that first semester of grad school, you know, I smoked my last cigarette, turned in that last paper, and then I got back into the pool.
Uh-huh. And that was it with the cigarettes?
That was it with the cigarettes.
How much were you smoking?
I was like 15 to a pack a day.
Right. Wow. That's tough to quit that.
Yeah. And I'd been built ramping that up for several years.
That's amazing.
But now it's like, that was, yeah, that was, it's over 6 years now.
Uh-huh.
Was it 6 years? Or over 5 years.
Right. Yeah. But it wasn't like, okay, I'm making a comeback.
Definitely not.
Mm-hmm.
I was, even if subconsciously I was thinking that, I was way too scared to admit it even to myself.
Mm-hmm. So it starts off with you, what, jumping into some master's workouts and then training a little bit with the women's team.
That's right.
With Terry.
You know, jumping into some master's workouts. Shout out to Fuego in Berkeley.
So there you have it. I'm so sorry, you guys. I just cannot believe this cut out right in the middle of a sentence, basically. I think we continued to talk for like 45 minutes, maybe even an hour, and the conversation just got better and better and better. So it just breaks my heart that this occurred. Nonetheless, I still think it was worth sharing with you guys. I'm really glad I did. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you got something positive out of it.